Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this webinar to the London School of Economics and Political Science. My name is Piroska Nagy-Mohácsi, and I am the Interim Director of the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics. I am truly pleased to be here today and chair the first of three events by the Central and Southeast European Programme of the LSE Ideas. The LSE Ideas, if you don't know, is the leading think tank of the world, according to consecutive indicators, consecutive years. This event, this particular event by the LSE Ideas is prepared and presented in partnership with the Polish Cultural Institute in London, for which we are very grateful. The event is being streamlined on the LSE Ideas channel and the Policy Institute's own webpage. This series that we are opening today will cover discussions to mark the 30th anniversary of the establishment of the Visegrad Group, or what is often called the V4, which will be falling on 15th of February this year. So it's been 30 years that the group is in existence. It was created as a cultural and political alliance of four Central European countries, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Slovakia in 1991 on February 15. The idea originally was to promote regional cooperation in military, cultural, economic, and energy matters, obviously a major concern at the time, and any other further common interests. So at 30 years in the making, maybe it's time to ask how this has worked. What's the track record? How has the alliance fared? What has it delivered relative to its objectives, the strengths, and of course the weaknesses? Have there been failures? And what are the current ambitions, the future role of this group of countries, the V4, within the EU, of course, and maybe more globally? So our three lectures will cover this particular record assessment, these issues. And we, of course, want to keep you in suspense to have the general sort of big bottom line of our assessment. As you will be hearing today from our speakers, you will have the first dosage of these assessments. But in the area of headlines and Twitter lines, if one were to be given a first impression and thought, I think that many of us would say that actually the alliance has worked. Has worked along moving concrete objectives. Let me highlight perhaps a few introductory observations in this regard. The first one takes us back historically. Interestingly, and I had to really Google it, I couldn't believe it myself, this alliance, and the name of this, dates back to 1335. This is when the Visegrad Congress of Bohemia, Hungary, and Poland, Bohemia, of course, the former Czech, the predecessor of the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, was created. 1335, almost 700 years ago. What was the objective then? To create a new commercial route to circumvent Vienna, which had imposed stamp duty and various other barriers to benefit from commercial trade through its borders. Very interesting, isn't it? And it was kept alive through the years, then of course massively changed. But these countries, these small open economies in the same vicinity, sharing the geographical, obviously geographical similarities, the political similarities, have been a very similar historic path. Many have been part of the Habsburg monarchy. Then later, all of them were part of the Soviet bloc. And even within that, I would say that informally these countries formed a certain alliance within the alliance, the broader Soviet bloc. So it was, I think, very natural that in 1991, following the fall of the Berlin Wall, as these countries embarked on a transition from the communist past to a democratic past and charted their path toward the EU, the European Union, which was very Western European centered, it was very natural that they also recreated this alliance. That was my point number one. Point number two is that even since 1991, it seems that the objectives very nicely evolved and have shifted, reflecting the issues of the day. Initially, there was a lot of shared interest in sharing the strategies and getting as fast as possible to the European Union. So a lot of that type of political and reform focus, one would say. Today, perhaps there are one more unique route that adds to this alliance. And that is that there is a strong sense of a refound identity and common interest in the fact that Eastern Central Europe is in a different shape or stage of economic and, more importantly, perhaps political development. And perhaps that also has played a role to shape this partnership. What do I have in mind? I'm referring to the brilliant Ivan Krastev in his latest book with Stephen Holmes, with the title "The Light That Failed," posits that Central Eastern Europe has followed too closely an imitation model of Western Europe, so to speak, copy and paste, and that has given rise a certain negative feeling, a feeling of inferiority. This imitation model. Whether this is really true or not, we can discuss perhaps today or later in the series. But I can say that even our own research in the LSE arena, recent research on Hungary confirms a very strong feeling in Hungary, one of the countries, of citizens feeling as a secondary EU citizen within the coalition. Also, some of the, that's my last point, some of the leaders in the region very clearly point to certain perceived cultural differences. I'm not sure this I would subscribe to as it is put. But the fact is that the very eloquent and charismatic Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has stated very strongly that in addition to, and I'm quoting, in addition to economic growth and its specificities, Central Europe is a region which also has some special culture that is different from Western Europe. We should discuss, I think, whether that is true or not. But certainly, there is a sense of common, strong, shared interest, economic, political, and perhaps cultural, in the region. But this is enough of the introduction. Today, we will be discussing the economics dimension of this alliance. We are delighted to have four excellent speakers, contributors to today's panel. We will start with Zsóka Kocan. Zsóka is a senior economist at the EBRD, EBRD's Office of the Chief Economist, and she previously worked at the International Monetary Fund. Then we will ask a second speaker, Christoph Mazur, a renowned political scientist who has also served as Undersecretary of State in the Polish Ministry of Development in 2019 and 20. After Christoph, the floor will be given to Martin Kahanets, a renowned professor of economics, and he's also the acting dean of the School of Public Policy at the Central European University in Budapest. And last, but definitely not least, we will hear from Lubomir Lizar, who's been president of the Anglo-American University in Prague since August 2018. He's a Czech economist who served most recently as a member of the board of the Czech National Bank. Our four panelists will offer opening remarks, and then we will be opening up for questions and answers. Please pose your questions in the chat function. I'm sure that in this long enduring traditional webinars, you all know how to do that. Kindly put your questions anytime, and we'll be monitoring them, and we'll try to address those to our panel speakers as they come in. A very few housekeeping matters still. The tweet for the Twitter users, please use the hashtag for today's event as hashtag one word LSE Visegrad at 30. So hashtag LSE Visegrad at 30. This online event is being recorded and we hopefully will be able to make it available also as a podcast. But enough of all this long introduction and the housekeeping matters. So please, we start our presentation, and I'm calling on Zsóka. Zsóka, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, as always. I will be representing the cross-country perspective here in EBRD colors. So hopefully you can all see my slides now.
Yes, very good.
Thank you. So I thought I would start by providing an update on where the countries, but more broadly speaking, Central and Southeastern Europe are now in the COVID-19 crisis, both from a public health perspective, but also looking at the economic impact of this. So those will be my first few slides, but then I will look a bit more at longer term trends, focusing in particular on employment. And Piroshka has spoken about the shared legacy of these countries. So with that in mind, I will talk a little bit about the decreasing role of the state in terms of employment, but also the role of foreign employment, these being very open economies. This is one of the characteristics that makes them stand out. So let me start with an update on the pandemic. Officially reported deaths from COVID-19 spiked in the last couple of months in much of emerging Europe. This chart, you can see official COVID deaths normalized by population. So here per million, the bars represent cumulative deaths since the start of the pandemic. The diamonds show them for the last 4 weeks. Much of emerging Europe, including the Visegrad countries, had a relatively mild first wave in the spring of 2020. However, cases have really picked up in recent months, as you can see from the diamonds, and this added up to cumulative deaths relative to population as well, so that by now many of the countries in emerging Europe appear to be harder hit than even some of the advanced economies that we hear a lot about in the headlines. Now, when we look at hospital admission rates, these paint a similarly bleak picture. Again, you can see a relatively milder spike in the spring of 2020 in terms of hospital admissions on a weekly basis. And then you can see this very depressing looking plateau in the last couple of months, where hospital admissions remain very high in the Visegrad economies. However, vaccination rates remain low in most of the world, including emerging Europe and including the Visegrad economies. As of last week's data, this would be below 1 or 1.5% of populations that have so far been vaccinated. Turning to the economic impact of the pandemic, this hit on top of an already ongoing deceleration of growth in many emerging European countries. The diamonds in this chart show you real GDP growth year on year for 2019, and this already represented a slowdown relative to previous years, 2017, 18, in many economies. You can see that for most countries, the first quarter of 2020, when the pandemic was just arriving in Europe, was already slower than previous years. On top of this came, of course, the sharp output contraction that we're all aware of in the second quarter of 2020. This reflected a combination of both domestic containment measures, such as lockdown and curfews, that weighed on domestic supply and demand. Estimates suggest that in 2019, over 40% of consumption involved close social contact, so that social distancing measures weighed on economic activity as well. It also represented a range of external factors that were weighing on growth. This includes, of course, the slowdown in trade, disruptions in global value chain linkages, and these are especially painful for very open economies. You can see large drops here, for example, for the Slovak Republic or for Hungary. I'm speaking from Hungary at the moment, where the Mercedes factory next to us is again on a temporary closure due to a shortage of parts from Japan at the moment. Other external factors that weighed on growth in these economies were, of course, a sharp drop in tourism and international travel. You can see that some of the largest contractions were in tourism-dependent economies in the Mediterranean, for commodity exporters, low oil prices, and for some economies dependent on remittances, restrictions on international travel, and that migration and remittances also dropped, affecting, for instance, some of the economies in the Western Balkans. Contractions in the third quarter of 2020 were relatively smaller in most countries, though, of course, these are very preliminary and the first estimates, and evidence from previous crises, including the global financial crisis, shows that these first estimates of growth tend to be subject to large revisions later on. So they should be taken with a grain of salt at this point. Now, countries responded to the economic damage with large fiscal stimulus packages to protect individuals and to protect firms. This shows fiscal stimulus as a share of GDP until the end of last year. In some economies, you can see that fiscal stimulus, including here, even if just above the line items, is around 3% of GDP in countries like the Slovak Republic, Hungary, or Poland. Now, EBRD did a survey together with the IFO Institute in August 2020, where we examined the early impact of the pandemic on individuals and firms. And this suggested that indeed job losses and business closures were less common in countries where stimulus packages were larger, so that some of the policies governments implemented were able to mitigate some of the damage and economic impact of the pandemic. But of course, large stimulus packages are also expected to significantly increase debt. So we would estimate debt to increase by 8-9 percentage points in some of our Visegrad economies. And this is driven by a combination of not only increased spending, but of course also the drops in GDP, so the denominator of this ratio. So with that, let me turn to perhaps some longer term trends that are interesting in terms of the economic performance of these countries today and reactions to the pandemic, but also for trends going forward. As Piroshka mentioned, of course, they share the heritage of a large state sector. Public sector employment has, as another transition, country come down significantly since the 1990s. So an average from over or around half of employment in the 1990s to about 20-25% today. So the role of the state, at least as an employer, has been decreasing, as we highlighted in our recent transition report. Now, this bar chart shows you a snapshot in time, drawing on rich individual level data from the Life and Transition Survey, and it breaks down employment further. So as I mentioned, you can see the bottom two bars, red and orange for state employment in the broader public sector. So this would include education, health, public administration, as well as employment in state-owned enterprises in orange. So you can see that these countries still stand out with much higher state employment than, for instance, advanced economies like the Germany or Italy. However, another area where these economies stand out, and this, of course, is related to them being very open and highly integrated in global value chains, is employment in foreign firms, where it is quite striking that, according to the survey in 2016, over 10% of those employed worked for foreign firms in Hungary. So, well, like much of emerging Europe, these countries benefited tremendously from large FDI inflows, especially before the global financial crisis. FDI inflows were attracted by a skilled labor force that was still relatively cheap, as well as, of course, proximity and access to the European market. It's generated a lot of jobs in this area, but also creates risk going forward, where deglobalization forces may be on the rise and there may be trade tensions among large economies that weigh on integration forces going forward. I mentioned that foreign firms generated a lot of employment in emerging Europe, and this data draws on the Financial Times FDI Markets Database, which is a project-level database of greenfield FDI inflows covering almost the last two decades in these economies. Now, it is very useful to us because it's project level and provides estimates of the number of jobs created as well as capital flows. What should be noted up front is that this is based on announcements. So some of the numbers I refer to jobs that were either generated or announced, so maybe generated at a future point in time over this period, and that some of the employment numbers may be estimates rather than actual values. But with those caveats, what this chart shows you is the share of employment generated by greenfield FDI, so specifically investment rather than changes in ownership, as a share of the change in total employment over 2003 to 2019. So for countries like Hungary and the Slovak Republic, this would suggest that greenfield FDI-related employment generated over this period would account for around three quarters of the total change in employment. For Poland, this would be roughly around a third. This is taking into account the direct impact, noting that, of course, jobs generated through foreign firms may be displacing domestic jobs and competitors, but that additionally they could be generating jobs along the supply chain through forward and backward linkages. Now, a lot has been written on the effects of foreign firms and FDI inflows on the domestic economy, including the effects on productivity, spillovers to domestic firms, supporting export discoveries. We wanted to do here is look at how foreign versus domestic firms behaved during the COVID-19 pandemic, and this draws on a new wave of the enterprise surveys the EBRD did with the World Bank and the EIB. And here you can see that among foreign firms, more firms started or increased working from home arrangements than among domestic firms. And this could be related to a lower number of layoffs among foreign firms as well. I mentioned earlier that foreign direct investment generated a lot of jobs, value-added, and supported growth in much of emerging Europe, and that this was especially the case in the run-up to the global financial crisis. So this is showing that as a chart where you can see the sort of boom-bust cycle of FDI inflows for emerging markets more generally, and this even more pronounced for some of the Visegrad economies. You can see that despite a recent pickup in these flows, they still haven't recovered to pre-global financial crisis levels. Put differently, the days of peak employment creation by foreign firms are likely over. This shows FDI manufacturing employment generated, and you can see that numbers are highest in the early 2000s before the global financial crisis. In the meantime, FDI inflows have shifted more from manufacturing towards services. They have also overall fallen, as you saw in the previous chart. In many countries, they have become less labor intensive over time. And we have also seen a shift towards jobs being generated in higher tech or higher skill sector. So this would suggest that going forward, while foreign firms were very important employers and generated a lot of employment in emerging Europe over the past two decades, the peak days of employment creation by foreign firms are likely over. We expect fewer jobs to be generated in the future, and we expect these jobs to be higher skilled. So with that in mind, I thought I would end on the implications of this for regional disparities as well. This is something that has received increased attention, including in some advanced economies in recent years. There is a sense that within country disparities have been increasing between urban and rural areas, between capital cities and secondary cities. So this map, if technology is on my side, will show you employment generation between 2003 and 2019 by location, drawing on a subset of projects for which we see. These are initially very much concentrated in capital cities, most of this being in construction. Then you see these scattered green dots appear. This would be the more dispersed manufacturing employment of the early 2000s, including many of it, for instance, in car factories. So this would be largely the Mercedes plant that I mentioned I'm sitting next to. But then in recent years, as flows have shifted more from manufacturing to service, you can see concentration and flows may be more concentrated in capital cities, worsening regional disparities, of course, also in line with the large literature of agglomeration effects mattering for FDI inflows. And then just let me add end on two links. So a lot of what I was presenting here draws on our recent regional economic prospects, and we'll have a new one coming out shortly, as well as a number of transition reports, with the latest one looking at the role of the state and the EBRD regions. Thank you very much. Let me end there and pass back to Piroshka.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Zsóka. It was a really a very comprehensive overview. I would ask you, if before going further, one question perhaps, if you allow me. And that is, why do you think that the COVID response has worsened so much in this region? What we have seen initially in up to like mid-June, end June, is that Central European countries, the Visegrad countries, actually have suffered less from COVID impact. But we see a very significant worsening relative to the to other regions, Western Europe included, as demonstrated in your chart, in this latter part, the new period. Is there any particular reason that you can point to that is behind this phenomenon?
That's a very good and very difficult question. It's actually a question we received a lot already in the spring, then with a different twist of why are these countries performing so well compared to some advanced economies. Now it's a question of why are they performing so badly. It's a very difficult question to answer. We've been crunching a lot of daily data recently that, among many other things, highlighted how dangerous and difficult it is to draw conclusions based on given snapshots in time. So for instance, if you look at the ranking of countries in cumulative deaths versus since the beginning of the pandemic versus the ranking of countries in terms of cumulative deaths over the last 4 weeks or last 2 months, these can differ significantly. Including because of the different timing of the arrival of different waves, as well as the timing of different policy responses. Some of the country's relatively better performance in the spring could reflect a combination of relatively early lockdowns together with possibly luck in terms of the timing of the arrival of virus, which came when weather was relatively milder, so it clashed less with other seasonal things. We tried to look at drivers of death rates more broadly. We do see a positive correlation. These are all very tentative findings for now. It's something we're looking at actively, but we do see a positive correlation that countries that have more cumulative deaths since the beginning of the pandemic also generally do worse in the last 4 weeks, even though there is a lot of variation around this relationship. Countries with generally older populations doing worse as mortality rates are higher among the elderly. We do see some, of course, correlations rather than causations, that countries that did more testing also find more cases and more deaths. Of course, the causation could run both ways. We looked at correlations with Google mobility as well to take into account the impact of the lockdowns, where we primarily see that indeed where there are more deaths and more cases, Google mobility has dropped more. And we see larger economic impacts as well, because countries had to react with stricter lockdowns, and even where this wasn't government, including voluntary social distancing. So I think we will continue looking into this. It is very difficult to explain. There is some evidence of cumulative deaths also varying with income levels. And we've seen very different policy responses across countries too.
Thank you so much. One quick technical question, which I think several audience members are wondering, whether it would be possible to, that you share your slides with the audience in one shape or form. Maybe we can get some advice through the course of the webinar on this. But let me now turn to Christoph Mazur. Christoph, the floor is yours.
Good evening for everyone. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure for me. Please allow me start with some remarks about Polish situation, and then I would like to conclude with some conclusions for the whole region, I hope. So if you would like to ask me in a very brief way how to summarize the situation now in Poland, I would say that among journalists, leader of the opinion, scholars, when we are talking about economy, it is a moderate optimism. I think that it's a proper expression how to summarize the situation nowadays. I think that everyone expects that this crisis will be not so deep as it was in 2008. And I think that many international think tanks agree with such an opinion and support such an opinion. For example, Oxford Economics put Poland among few countries in EU without long-term impact on GDP and revenues. And I think that this is something, if the future will be like this, I would be very very pleased. And also OECD economic surveys for 2020 also wasn't very pessimistic for Poland. And also it was another argument for a public debate, how to think about future and how to think about our contemporary situation. If you would like to summarize the what have been done and what really happened in 2020, I would say that's exactly as it was in the previous presentation. We've got two waves of introduction restrictions, and two ways of freezing and unfreezing our economy. And if I would have to summarize this effect of this actions, I would say that this first wave the reaction both when we are talking about healthcare situation and when we are talking about economy situation was quite positive. After first wave, the effects were really positive. After second wave, it was quite opposite. October, for example, it was one of the worst months in Polish history after the Second World War, when we are talking about number of deaths. And it is a huge question you ask, Piroshka, why the effects of the first and the second wave are so different. I think that's my opinion and my answer on this question is that something really changed in the social perception of the COVID and social perception of the pandemic. I think that we get used to it and we try to think that during the summer that everything what was the worst just is in the past, and now we can go back to normality. And I think that was one of the most important factor. Then my third remark will be how our state react on COVID. And I would say that before the pandemic, there were a huge debate about general position of the state. We can say that on the one side there were a civic platform leading by Donald Tusk with quite liberal approach. It was a very common opinion that state should be a night watchman. And we shouldn't. The state shouldn't play an important role in the economy. And then after 2015, when Law and Justice won the election, the perspective changed strongly. I think that citizens, both citizens and government, expect much more active role of state in the economy. For example, one of the book of Mariana Mazzucato about the state as an entrepreneur were quite popular among intellectuals and among government. And I think that it shows that there is an expectation that state should play a much more important role. And we can say that according to this shift, according to this change, Polish state try be not a night watchman during the pandemic, but try to play an important role, not only when the state implements restrictions, but also when there was a debate about the aid purchase and the aid and how to support the economy. And according to International Monetary Fund, this public aid for Polish economy were one of the biggest in the EU. It was 12% of our GDP, and the European average is around 10%. So it shows that somehow Polish state tried to not leave alone Polish entrepreneurs, Polish laborers without support. So if you would like to summarize how this public aid was implemented, I would say that there were three pillars. First pillar, where the main goal was to support the labor market. It was obviously some layoffs, redemptions and surges. And I think that the effect of this actions were quite positive, because our rate unemployment rate has increased by 1%, to 6.3%. I would like to remember that after Lehman Brothers and after 2008, the unemployment rate increased 2%. So I think that's here the goals were achieved. Second pillar and second goal was to maintain the liquidity of companies. And here a crucial role plays Polish Development Fund. It was 100 billion zlotys direct transfer for companies. And also here, I think that these goals were achieved. And the third pillar was to provide some financing for investments. Here, crucial role were played by National Development Bank. Their main goal was to offer attractive loans for Polish companies. And I think that the mix of those three pillars, of this three way how to support Polish economy, gives those quite positive effects, which I called a moderate optimism on the beginning of my presentation. Obviously, such an active role also means negative effects for economy. For sure, we can underline here that the public debt increased from 46% to GDP on the beginning of the pandemic to around 58% nowadays. So it was 12-point increase, and I think that's obviously such a fiscal policy leads to some uncertainty of public finance, and also it means costs of debt in the future. And I think that this is something we should also remember about. Also, another second negative aspect of result of this policy is increase of inflation. Now, inflation in Poland is around 3%, and I think it is the highest in the EU. Okay, we can say that according to the National Bank of Poland, it should be 2.5, so the difference is not so big, but still we are talking about the highest the inflation in EU. So this is how the landscape looks like, and I think that everybody in Poland expected 2021 will be. A time when we will be back to the normality, and also, as I said, that there will be no long-term impact on GDP and our revenues. But now I would like to, on the end of my presentation, I would like to say a few words about some general conclusions, also conclusions important, as I mentioned, for the whole region. What are the challenges and what are the lessons from this time? I think that there are three. First, we got a huge challenge how to rebuild trust. I think that the worst what happened during the pandemic, or what's still going on during the pandemic, is a huge damage of social trust. Obviously, here we can talk about trust to government, because this government has to act very quickly, sometimes without very good communication to the society. Sometimes citizens think that the reactions were not proper, not sufficient, not also well communicated. And it means that after a year of such uncertainty and a year of somehow a year of fear, we can see that, that there is a damage of social trust. And I think that it is a challenge not only in Poland but in the whole world. And I think that the way how to go back to the globalization when the trust is one of the important factor and those open economy as it was said before, when the trust that it is beneficial for everyone, I think it's the crucial point. And second thing which is connected with this trust is that we can see that that are some negative aspect of globalization, and as I mentioned, that if we would like to be as much open as an economy in the future as it was in the past, we have to redefine economy, redefine globalization. Obviously, here there are we can mention about the whole debate about strategic autonomy. Very hot topic nowadays in EU. We have to talk about supply chains. We have to talk about, as it was mentioned before, those greenfield FDI. But what I would like to underline as the absolutely crucial is the question, do we still believe that such a system is beneficial for everyone? And I think that there are some question marks during this year, which were wide debate in Poland. For example, one of the moments when this question mark was very visible, it was when Polish Development Fund wanted to give some financial support for Polish companies, and there were very long time we expected for notification of public aid from European Commission. And during those days, there were some articles of prominent Polish CEO of Polish companies. Why it took so long? Why we cannot receive support from the state? And I think that it was one of the moment when those question mark was so visible. Another moment is nowadays is about vaccine. In the previous presentation, there were numbers that Poland and Central Europe, before, if you want, we are not so fast in this process. But I would like to remember that and underline that the crucial point in this process is how many vaccine we receive. And during last few days, we received information that one of the global company wouldn't give vaccine in numbers as it was expected, as it was in the contract. And another question for globalization, another question for trust, another question for justice rules for everyone. And I think that it's is something should be widely discussed. So it's a second.
Christoph, sorry, I just would remind you of time because wrap it up if possible.
Yeah. Okay. So the last point. So the first was to rebuild social trust. Second, redefine globalization. And third was how to show the before as a region, as a great place for investment, but not as it was mentioned before, manufacturing, employment, but higher tech sector. I think that's the third challenge. I couldn't speak about it more because I'm out of the time. Sorry.
Thank you very much. And I am so sorry that I have to be this trying in this chair too, because that indeed, thank you very much for this very comprehensive assessment and the last 3 points, sort of the major challenges, and you highlight indeed what is becoming a big challenge to move away from manufacturing lower skilled employment to employment creation in the high tech, more innovative sectors. It's something that rhymes also what Zsóka made a point of. May I ask you just one quick question? You're a political scientist, so I think you're the most appropriate person to ask the question that has been posed by Simon Graves from the FT, who is also a PhD student. It's wonderful. And Simon is asked whether you see any chances that this V4, the Visegrad 4, would expand this alliance and include any other countries to pursue a common interest? Or do you think that this is more or less the format, the membership that what we see today? Just a short answer, since it's on people's mind.
I really admire how Romania, for example, is now very prominent state for IT companies. I think that the one of the biggest unicorn in our region, I mean Central Europe region, won't be in Poland, won't be in Hungary, Czech or Slovakia, but in Romania. And I think that it is something we should be aware of. And links, for example, between Poland and Romania on this level, on this IT level, blockchain startups, fintech startups, are really vivid, and from my perspective, we should think about the Central Europe as a broader group of countries. And from my perspective, it's nothing bad to open this formula and to format for other countries.
So you see reasons to be more inclusive, even if it's not formalized immediately. Thank you very much, and thank you, Simon, for your question. Please continue to pose your questions, and as you have seen in the chat, if you would like to get Zsóka's slides, there's an email address, and that will be emailed to you. Next is Martin Kahanes from the CEU. Martin, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Piroshka, and thank you very much for the organizers for having me here. If I were to summarize the 30 years of experience of Visegrad countries, the easiest way is to go to visegradgroup.eu. You open up that website, and what you see is a banner which shows a map of the Visegrad four countries with a partly cloudy signs. They are partly cloudy. You see suns and you see clouds. And that's how I see it. Overall, a success story, a lot of sun, a lot of positive developments in the economy, but there are challenges looming. And of course, the key question is, are the clouds coming in and more clouds, or is this, will the skies clear up? And that's my intervention here in a nutshell. But let me go through some stories and narratives, how I see the past decades in Visegrad, and then I give you a little bit on labor mobility and its role, and then I finish with some reflections on future challenges. Very briefly, you look at the data, what you see is employment rates growing in all four Visegrad countries in this century. Short dips following the 2008 crisis. And so far, so good. In 2020, only a relatively small decrease in participation. When you look at unemployment rates, it's actually an interesting pattern, because unemployment rates in the region have been peaking every 10 years, early 1990s, early 2000s, and early 2010s, which is not very optimistic for the next 2-3 years, and maybe that's what's going to happen again, a slightly increased unemployment rates. But generally, that's also a relatively positive picture, with unemployment rates recently declining. But we will see how COVID will exactly affect the figures. The shockwave is yet to fully unfold, and my personal expectation is that the increase in unemployment will not be particularly high, and it will be temporary, also depending on how effective the vaccine will be. Look at wages, steadily growing, converging to European European Union levels from some distance, of course, but that's also a relatively positive story. Minimum wage is approaching 600 euros in all four countries except Hungary, where it's 450 euros, also a steady growth. Union membership and density is deeply declining. That's a major, major trend, major phenomenon that unions have been weakening, and their power has been declining. Productivity is steadily growing, highest levels ever. Czech Republic, Hungary, some slowdown since the 2000s, since the late 2000s, still slowly growing, but at a lower rate. We see a dip, not a trivial dip in 2020 in Czech Republic, smaller dip or some disturbance in Poland and Hungary, but no drama yet. We will see what we get in 2021. The COVID-19 crisis. So far, relatively modest effects on labor markets, given the magnitude of the overall shock. But what it has done, the pandemic, it has really exposed the weaknesses of institutions, economic, labor market institutions, and governance. And we will see how exactly that will play out in the coming months, and what will be the overall effects eventually. Overall, the last three decades, the overall picture looks good. What we also see that the levels have been improving, but also more recently, what we see is that there is growing resilience to economic shocks. The markets have, in spite of the weaknesses I mentioned, there has been a positive evolution of institutions and coordination. Coordination mechanisms that are helping these countries to be more resilient to economic shocks. However, and this is now some clouds on the horizon, the demographic trends are not very encouraging. We see relatively steep population decline in Hungary, some decline in Poland, Slovakia, some growth, but slower. And Czech Republic shows an interesting pattern because formerly it had been already declining, but then population growth has re-emerged over the past about 10 years or so. Yet there is there are some additional demographic challenges, steep aging, increasing old age dependence ratio, and weak educational institutions overall, generally speaking. Much of it unreformed and in dire need of reform. What we also see is relatively low labor mobility within these countries. Primarily, one of the key factors being high home ownership rates. Slovakia, Czech Republic are at the top of the, also Poland and Hungary pretty high, but Slovakia especially high, topping in the very top of the European Union in terms of home ownership rates. We do see significant out-migration, especially young people, and also generally negative stance towards immigration. So that these demographic trends are limiting the economic potential of the Visegrad 4 countries. A little more on mobility, labor mobility, especially Poland and Slovakia lost significant numbers of young and skilled workers in the post-enlargement period. Then it has sort of kind of wave, which slowed down since then. Czech Republic never was a major source country, and Hungary initially not so very much, but it's a kind of latecomer in this, and more recently had been the source of significant migration flows, recently, I mean, a few years. Out-migration is relatively skilled, young, and strongly attached to the labor market. But it's also downskilling. So it's these migrants from Central Eastern Europe when they work in Poland, Austria, in Germany, Austria, UK, etc. And they are working in occupations which are below their former levels of education, which adds to the demographic challenges. We're losing qualified young labor force, which is not always most efficiently employed in the destinations. Initially, migrants primarily went to those countries which opened up early on, UK, Ireland, then more Germany and Austria, with interesting gender patterns, which has initially more females, more since, and then slowly turning the tide, more males migrating. Generally, this migration, and this is an important message here, that post-enlargement migration from Visegrad countries and new member states more generally has positively contributed to EU's GDP per capita efficiency. And we show, we can document with data that these migrants, they are rather mobile, and they are they go to those sectors, occupations and countries where there are labor shortages. So they're actually filling gaps, and they grease the wheels of the European economy. Actually more than native populations. And we don't observe welfare shopping for welfare in the data. That's not a statistically, systematically, the phenomenon that we could show statistically and a significant part of Europe's experience. So loss of skilled labor limits V4's economic potential. And Visegrad 4 countries have actually become destinations, especially Czech Republic, also Poland, to some extent, and I mean, all of four of them, but there are negative attitudes to immigration. And so there is a limited potential that migration will add to dynamism in these countries. Although I say the Czech Republic may be an exception, because it has received quite significant numbers of immigrants. So, last slide. In light of these demographic changes and developments, the relatively positive recent labor market trends in employment, unemployment wages may in fact, as positive as they are, they may in fact herald a problem in the context of those the demography. Because there are signals that the low-hanging fruit is already gone, and labor shortages are, and that's what we hear from HR managers, labor shortages are already rather severe. Now, of course, more recently we have a crisis, but that's temporary. So I expect the overall trend not to change too much. Labor mobility is low, and it's and cross-border mobility is not very much wanted. Inward mobility, immigration. And domestic capacity to produce qualified labor and spur innovation is limited, with a relatively under-reformed educational sector and limited reforms in the health sector and relatively weak health sector. So my conclusion here is that the positive trends that we observe are likely to slow down, stall, and V4 are likely to find themselves in the middle income trap due to the limiting demographic factors. Final remarks, challenges and opportunities ahead for Visegrad 4 countries, automation, digitalization, this will affect these countries very much. Slovakia has been highlighted as one of those countries which has highest degrees of substitutability of its labor by automated processes. I'm not too, I'm a bit skeptical about those studies, but still one has to think about it seriously. Climate change affecting these countries just like any other, not that's not only direct changes, but also the adjustment and the economic adjustment, new technological adjustment that it also spurs. And migration flows that it may also spur. Declining economic potential due to aging depopulation and inadequate health and education institution as another challenge. Growing polarization, political, economic, etc. And what's been already mentioned, trust, disinformation, democratic backsliding are affecting Visegrad 4 countries as well, also risks of democratic backsliding. like in trust. So I would conclude that the Visegrad 4 countries need to again reinvent themselves for the 21st century and think about their role in the European landscape and in the global landscape, and think about how they can foster inclusive growth, innovation, and democratic governance. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Martin. And thank you very much for building in also region-wide new elements like democratic, demographic trends, but also the but some pursues and states backsliding in democracy as such. Important point. In the interest of time, let me not raise now questions, just move to our last presenter and then raise questions because they are now coming in. And please, I'm asking the audience to continue to pose your questions. We are getting to them very shortly. I'm asking now beforehand, however, for Lubomir Lizal to take the floor. Lubomir, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I would like to be brief since I think there are a couple of questions coming in, but nevertheless, I think several remarks should have been made. And I would go back to the origin of the V4, of the Visegrad Group. Actually, one thing wasn't mentioned yet, and I think it's a pity. That was actually that these four countries has actually at the same time they have founded something which was called Central European Free Trade Agreement. And it was viewed as a vehicle how to establish a free trade zone and to sort of mitigate the dismantling of the Comecon markets. On the other hand, in the early 90s, it was not rational for these countries to assume that they would become EU members soon. So the response was creating of the Central European Free Agreement, CEFTA. And actually this vision of a free trade has survived. Yeah, the founding countries are no longer members of the CEFTA because they become members of the EU. On the other hand, that free trade agreement has been steadily enlarging. First, there has been Slovenia coming in and other countries. Then right now, they are completely different countries that were originally at the beginning. But it actually shows the ambitions that there were in the early 90s. And because of the EU entry, I think that was something that helped these countries a lot, getting to the big markets and being part of the big markets. On the other hand, it has left the Visegrad Group as only, which you might call the cultural or grand agency, and not the original aim which was behind the free trade, since these countries have achieved that differently. And I think it's a remarkable success of the Visegrad groups that probably they haven't envisioned at the beginning of the creation of the Visegrad Group. Some other things which I would mention is that I would agree with the first presentation that was showing actually the effect of declining state importance on the employment. In the early 90s, what was viewed was that these countries, the Visegrad Group, they had a significant portion of the economy that was tied with the state. I mean, some estimates are showing that at the beginning of the 1990, like the Czech Republic and Slovak Republic, that time they had like only 5% of the GDP that was created in the private sector. Hungary, it was slightly better off, and Poland, they had significant part of GDP created in the private sector, just due to the fact of structural differences, namely in the agriculture. On the other hand, all these countries, they have selected some methods of privatization, how to move the economy toward the classical market-based economies, and all of them succeeded. It's quite a different methods how to get there. So So I think within 10 years, all these countries had the majority of the GDP being in private sectors, and they were ready to enter the EU. And I think it was enormous speed if you think about the structure of the economies in 1990, and that decade and 3-4 years later, they have been able to fulfill the EU criteria and join the market. I think it was that was enormous success. What we also see during the period of the 90s and later on as well was real economic convergence, that these economies, they have been growing economically, and the gap between the old EU 12 and these countries, that new entrants, has been narrowing. So that's sort of like a support of the theory of the economic convergence. On the other hand, what we see today is that the structural differences are still in place and they are not vanishing. So it shows that while the economic convergence might be fast, the structural convergence is not happening. And this is some of the arguments that might be used in the debate of the appropriate or not appropriate usage of the euro currency, and that's actually in these economies quite often used. And I think this is one of the reasons why you could see that the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary, they have not opted for the euro. And the reason is that these economies are big enough to grab the advantages of own currency in case of need. On the other hand, the Slovak economy being the smallest one out of the four, then I think the advantages of extremely open economy prevails, and that's why the euro was, I think, a good way for the Slovak economy. Also, in Slovakia, the euro served as an anchor of economic reforms. So that's sort of one of the differences which I would highlight. One thing which I consider remarkable as well is the development in the protection of the environment. When you look at the emission figures of the sulfur dioxide or the dust in the V4 countries in 1990, then you could see enormous amounts of emissions. And within 10 years, these countries were able to cut these emissions to 1/10 of the original. I think that was one of the biggest help in prolonging the expected lifetime, since the outside the environment has improved significantly, and you could see it. Basically, for the listeners to have an anecdotal evidence, in the literature you could see you could read about the London fog in the beginning of the 20th century or during the coal burning period when you couldn't see the people. So actually there were regions where in the late 80s, you could have similar effects, that the pollution was extreme. So this is something which has vanished. And I consider that to be also one of the biggest advances that have been made. And since I would like to be brief, let me just end with maybe a provocative note, and this is about the future. I think that the V4 countries have a natural partner in the EU, being the UK. And the UK has left the EU, which sort of shifted the balances in favor of the Eurozone. Since right now, the countries that do not use the euro, they have much weaker position than they used to have. And they have to learn how to work within the EU without having the natural partner, I would say, the UK, which was also focused on free trade heavily. And this is why I've started with the note on the CEFTA agreement, since that was something which was at the roots of the, it was like the cornerstone of the before the ambitions. And since the UK was also was heavily focused also on promoting the less regulation and more of the exchanges, then I think the EU might look somehow differently without the UK than it used to be. So thank you for the time, and that was my introductory remark.
Thank you very much, Lubomir. Even though based on debating for the last to speak, you brought in very new elements, highlighting some differences and also your vision for the future challenges after the Brexit has taken place. Thank you so much. Now let's open up the questions that are coming up, or continue rather. The question that got actually the most votes from you audience is from Bo Yi Lee, who is a PhD candidate at King Business School. And he's asking whether you think that there will be more economic cooperation between the V4, Visegrad 4, and Asian countries in the near future, and in what instance. In the interest of time, I'd like you to be brief in your answering. Maybe Lubomir, you have the floor. What do you think?
Yeah, brief answer, no. I think that right now there is more stress on the EU coordinated approach. So in that case, I think it's going to be just the EU determination that would be defining these relationships.
Christoph?
It's a difficult question because Asia is a huge continent, and I think that what is visible is that approach for Chinese investments in Europe has been changing, and I think that is something what is an important role, for example, in debate in Germany, and last few months the German opinion leaders for investments from China from very optimistic changing into quite pessimistic or skeptical. So I think that it is something what is changing on our in contemporary world. But on the other hand, for example, Korean investment in Poland, I think that they play a crucial role, for example, around Wrocław. There are some global Korean high-tech companies which started another grassroots factory, grassroots investment. So I think that it is difficult to answer yes or no, because as I said, Asia is the huge continent, and it depends on which countries we are talking about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next highest ranking question is from John Mason, and like to ask this from Joka and perhaps Martin. This is, will the trend in job losses and closures, EU business consolidations, lead to a labor market in the Visegrad 4, which is much harder for people in terms of real wage increases and the like? Maybe I can put it a little bit broadly, expand a little bit the question and ask what you both have alluded to, but to go a little bit deeper on the future of work in the region. We heard some big challenges coming from manufacturing jobs fading out, and the challenge of a more knowledge-based economy. I would question that, what is the role of foreign firms, which traditionally have been a lead innovator in dispenser of innovation in the region. So what is the future of work? How you see and also real wage increases in general? First, maybe Martin, then Zsolka.
Thank you, Piroshka. Excellent question, very big question, there's many aspects. If you think about the future of labor, there are several trends. Yes, one is the pandemic has increased risk aversion and has risk of people, but also investors. And so some investment may be going may land rather in inside the European Union than outside for those such reasons. And so in some of these countries, Slovakia has already experienced new investment announcements. Which have been cancelled outside of Europe, and they've been replaced, relocated after they've been announced for countries outside Europe. Relocation has been announced, and they'll be coming to Slovakia. And I'm not sure this is the case also in other countries, but I can imagine why this is happening. So some investment is brought back to the European Union. Then the major trends like automation, digitalization, etc. They will. I'm not so much worried about whether there will be jobs. I believe in, and that's been shown in the data that labor markets adapt to new conditions rather. In spite of the frictions and unemployment, eventually they adapt and adjust to new situations. But what is a major challenge is the distribution and the polarization in labor markets and inequalities. Yes. And then one of the key challenges for these countries is keeping social cohesion and keeping all parts of the society participate in prosperity, so to say, and in growth. Let's leave it at this reflection on the question, and I hand over to Zsolka.
Okay, great, Zsolka.
I would agree with a lot of Martin's points. I think job creation going forward is one of the key challenges for the region. I think putting it very simplistically, the region moved from the state as a key employer to foreign firms as very important generators of new jobs with, as was mentioned before me, the sort of safety valve of immigration, where we did see a lot of young people, including high-skilled, emigrate, which of course kept domestic unemployment rates low, but also weighed down growth potential. I think maybe if I could just bring back the previous question on Asia and links to Asia as well, where I think that to the extent that such links will strengthen, it may be with a twist. So when we were looking at the Greenfield FDI data, we looked at links with China and inflows from China and other emerging markets more broadly for the whole EBRD region, so including emerging Europe, but also Central Asia and the Southern and Eastern Mediterranean. We saw was indeed a significant increase in inflows from China since 2013 and the start of the Belt and Road Initiative, much more so in Central Asia and parts of the Western Balkans than in the Visegrad country. So I think China's share of greenfield FDI in Poland is less than 1%. But one of the things that came out of this that I thought was interesting looking forward was that while projects from China were typically larger, they were less labor intensive than those from, for instance, Germany or the US. So they created fewer jobs per million US dollars invested, which of course is consistent with many of these being in extraction and resource seeking areas. It's also consistent with China's comparative advantage at home of having already access to a large pool of cheap labor there and not needing to go abroad for this. And maybe let me end there.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. One more question, which got a lot of votes, is from Buz Gültekin, who is a master's student at the Middle East Technical University. The question relates, reinvoking the Krasia invitation model and the drawbacks coming from that. But the question is something that we haven't really addressed. And what is the perception and the impact of the EU recovery funds and the resilience loans and grants on the relationship between the countries, Visegrad countries and the EU? Of course, we all know that there have been political tensions that were resolved between two of the Visegrad countries, Poland and Hungary and the EU, when a deal was struck in December. to move ahead with the budget and the recovery fund usage with softened conditions on linking these the use to the rule of law, or clarifying perhaps that particular condition. So there has been a compromise, but I would like to ask actually all of you for a brief view on the impact of EU recovery funds availability now, and the perception and the political views in these countries, and the impact on the relationship between, if you want, Brussels and the V4. So whoever wants to start, Lubomir, I call you on this.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think it more depends on the situation in each country. Since, you know, when I look at the history of the cohesion funds, how these were used, then you could see quite significant differences between the countries, how they were able to use that. And my impression is that actually the Czech Republic wasn't good enough in that. But that might be just our own disadvantage in the Czech Republic. So I would say that this fund could be used wisely, which means they could help to create new jobs and move the economy forward. On the other hand, you know, always whenever you have some funds that are sort of tied with certain strings that they can be used for certain areas. You always have the problem that these areas might be selected rigidly, or there might be error in selecting of these areas. So this is something which we will know only ex post. So I hope that that the funds would be sort of flexible enough for the countries to use them when there is a real need. On the other hand, it's just another way of redistribution. Yeah, since these funds are typically taken out of the countries first, and by general taxation, just call it as we want. It's just a transfer from let's say private industries that are then redistributed back to the private industries. And I would say that each redistribution has pros, but also it has cons of the redistribution, that it might be too costly to actually provide the actual benefit. It might be easier just to allow the countries to have these funds available locally. On the other hand, yes, the funds that are sort of on a global level of the EU, they might be sort of cheaper to get funded. So there might be an advantage of funding them.
Thank you. Christoph?
Three short comments. First, I think that it is a step towards federalization of EU. I think that it is a crucial moment when bonds could be emitted not only by particular states, but by the whole EU, and I think that is an important aspect of fiscal policies, which leads to the federalization, as I said. Second, obviously, it is a great opportunity, especially because those two main goals, green economy and digitalization. I think that those both goals are not only goals of the whole EU, but of the V4 countries, or each of our countries in particular. So I think that those funds will support development of the region. And third comment, I think that we are not aware enough that the extra points will be given for projects which could be described as the European flagships. It means that in Poland we discuss what should be on our list projects, but we are thinking only about, you know, very very often only about our internal goals. But those European flagships, there are projects which are not important from perspective of particular state, but the whole region. And I think that it is a great field for a cooperation between the four countries to create projects which should be treated by Brussels as flagships for the whole region or for the whole EU. Thank you.
Martin, any thoughts on that, or Zsolka? Martin, first, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. 3 points briefly adding to my the speakers before. First point, I'm actually a member of the council that's discussing how to use and how to implement these funds in Slovakia. One of the crucial things, especially for Slovakia, is that we have that's a large amount of money. Plus, we have some unspent money from structural funds and EU funds, and so this is a huge amount of money which we need to invest in the coming few months, years. And one of our main worries is the absorption capacity and actually the how we can actually implement the funds. Second thought is that this money is temporary, so it's one of opportunity. So what we are thinking about is how to use it in a way which elevates the country to higher productivity, higher technological innovation and more efficient economy, which is then sustainable, yes, in a way which is sustainable even without, you know, after the funds are gone. As a scientist, I'm always thinking also about some kind of hidden effects, which is that these funds may crowd out. I mean, if there is a risk that the funds will crowd out some other investment or some other government spending. So they'll be actually replacing other spending by governments. And so the net effect may be actually in that such case lower than what it would be otherwise. Other than that, the reception in Slovakia, general reception is positive, and these additional funds are seen as an opportunity to elevate the country to a higher production possibilities frontier, if I may say so. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Excellent. And Zsolka, finally?
Very briefly, from a purely economic backward-looking perspective, these countries, of course, benefited tremendously from EU funds to the point that, with a little bit of exaggeration, we could say that the pattern of some of these countries' growth rates is basically Germany's GDP growth rate with a residual on top. I think with that in mind, looking forward, the key challenge would be to reinvent the growth model. I think this is something that everyone was aware of even before the pandemic. So as a result of headwinds, we heard of the demographic headwinds, where there's a concern that the countries will grow old before they grow rich, as a concern of being stuck in transition with opposition to reforms, or being stuck in the middle income trap. But I think the key challenge is to find a new growth model. And we know that innovation, switching to digital technologies, may not necessarily have been their strong points in the past today. Then you can see this as evidence that indeed more investments in digital infrastructure are needed.
Thank you very much. This has been a rich and delightful and a fun discussion, as far as I can see. I will make a half a minute attempt to try to just highlight the key aspects. We looked at the economic dimension of the region of these four countries. Necessarily, through the short-term pattern of the COVID crisis impact, this is unavoidable, but also, as Zsolka said, also the longer-term impact. And in terms of economics, the big challenge is how to reinvent the growth model, as many of you said. It includes the future of work, the role of innovation, knowledge-based approach. It does include the demographic trends and the impact of what is there, the negative disposition toward migration that would ease up labor market conditions. It does include, as several of you mentioned, the role of the state, as Christoph said, should we think about the Mazzucato type of entrepreneurial state that stays and has a higher impact as a result of the COVID impact, or should be a little bit more worried about the state overstaying, not only in terms of the policy package, but also through state banks and the like. And let's hope that the incentives are more sort of toward a benevolent entrepreneurial state in this regard. You mentioned building trust, rebuilding trust. This was very important, both in building social cohesion, as Martin mentioned, and also fighting disinformation as a challenge. And finally, you all alluded to the future of this bloc. Our audience was very much interested in this. Will there be a possible expansion, perhaps, into a V5 or so? Or how should the V4 itself, the bloc, reinvent itself? As Lubomir said, there's a new challenge in the sense that the natural ally, if you wish, the UK, in many respects, free trade, less regulation, is now not part of the EU, and that rebalances economic approaches a little bit within the EU, and how the bloc can really reinvent itself in this new environment. The London School of Economics, which hosts this event, sitting in London in the UK, I think we can say that let's hope that the UK will rapproach and will not have left forever, and that the challenge in this respect will be a really objective rebalancing as such. I want to thank you all for very much, Zsóka, Martin, Lubomir, and Christoph. You've been fantastic panelists. Thank you for the audience for staying with us over 90 minutes, sitting there and being engaged with us. Thank you, and then please tune in for the next of the series that will be on February 15th, and that will be a cultural event. So we shift, blessedly, we shift out of the economic concerns, and we will see the region's cultural contribution. The title is Seeing Central Europe, Theatre and Film in Visegrad Countries. So Monday the 15th at 4 p.m. will join us. And again, thank you all, and thank you to the audience for a wonderful exchange and discussion. Thank you. Bye. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very much. Thank you.